Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast, originally recorded in 2001, is with the late Robert W. Fogel, 1993 Nobel Prize in Economics, and James Heckman, 2000 Nobel Prize in Economics. We hope you enjoy today's podcast, and don't forget to subscribe to get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
So, Bob, I have a question for you. What do we know, after all these years, about the sources of economic growth? I mean, economists have been working on this since Adam Smith and maybe even before. But fads, trends have come along, and it seems that the subject is very much up still in the air. What's your thinking about this?
Well, I think there are fads, but there's also a strong line of continuity that's interpreted economic growth in terms of shifting production functions. And the main shifts are brought about by changes in technology and underlying changes in the technology, scientific knowledge. And that goes back at least to early Schumpeter. You can find strong elements of it in Mitchell and Kuznets. Mm-hmm. Built a lot of his career on it. And I think in recent times, Zvi Gerlichus and Dale Jorgensen were very much down that line of analysis, placing a lot of emphasis on technological change. Dale Jorgensen, I think, has also emphasized the role of capital formation as the vehicle through which new technology is embodied. Mm-hmm. So he associates a lot of economic growth with high levels of investment, not just in machines and in buildings, but also in human capital.
Human capital. The question is, do we have a good theory, do you think, yet, about the underlying determinants of technological change, though? I mean, economists have worried about this. There's some recent work by young economists about endogenous technical changes, older work, Black, and so forth. What's your take on this? My view is not very positive in the sense that, so far, it would be very nice to have such a theory, but I'm not sure we have it. What's your take on that?
Well, I don't see a lot of difference between the new and the old economic growth. And Zvi Gerlichus told me that he was once at a meeting of people in emphasizing the new economic growth, endogeneity, and said, oh, we had all of that in footnotes.
Well, there's some truth. I noticed recently a reading list on the new, so-called new economic growth. And I'd read half of the papers when I was a graduate student, and that disturbed me. It can't be that new. But there is a question, though, about the tech. Here's a question you raised, though. And the evidence in the 80s, the statements in the 80s were made about massive externalities, spillovers, and these kind of an unspecified type as being in a central feature of economic growth. That was allegedly the distinguishing feature. But has there been such evidence? My view is we don't see that. That's really not what's going on.
And I don't think it's held up.
Yeah, that's my view.
I mean, I don't think that's, as I read the current literature and as I approach it in my own analysis, technological change, scientific changes in scientific knowledge embodied in new technologies is still the motor, the engine of economic growth. And other things matter, but they matter as constraints or as things that stimulate the potential that's there through the new technology.
But how do we get new ideas? One of the fascinating questions that always bothers me and many economists, right, is how do you get an Albert Einstein or how do you get a Newton? I mean, we know very little. Very little in economics tells us that if we give an extra dollar to graduate education, we're certain, or even with a high probability, going to produce a new genius.
Yeah, I tell you, I have a very, I'm still looking for my first authentic genius. among people I know. We've certainly had a brilliant century. And both you and I have had contact in our own field with some of the most brilliant people. And because we've been citizens of universities, we've known them in other fields, physics, chemistry. My next door neighbor is one of the great chemists. A neighbor diagonally across is one of the great biomedical investigators. And when you sit down with them, they seem like nice people. They don't strike you as sort of bright beyond. And I suppose the most common quality is that they're extraordinarily hardworking. They're dedicated to their work.
Right.
And
well, remember Edison's phrase about genius, you know, 99% perspiration, 1% inspiration.
Right. So. And I think he had it. There's very little to add to that. That doesn't mean...
But even how do we produce those people? Forget about Einstein and Newton. I mean, the real question is, I mean, science policy is something very much on the table. People are asking, how do we stimulate the production of these ideas? You mentioned, I think it's correct, that that ideas are the driving force of technology, but and technology is itself embodied by these, embodying these ideas. But how do we produce those ideas? How do we get a framework, an environment?
Well, but the knowledge is accumulative. And as we accumulate a certain amount of knowledge, a whole new vista opens up. Mm. Nobody 200 years ago, Newton, would not have thought in terms of mapping the genome and trying to figure out the extent to which we can intervene and rearrange genes in such a way as to affect biological species. Mm-hmm. That was a long process. You couldn't have computers until you had electricity. So each new advance opened up a very wide range of new possibilities. And I think these new possibilities are leaped on pretty quickly. I mean, look how short a time period it is from the transistor to the microprocessor, mm-hmm. or from having a theory of DNA to saying, let's map the human genome.
Well, the pace is accelerating. Now,
pace is accelerating. Everything is going quicker.
But for example, let me step back though from this though. I mean, so I agree with you. In the last 50 years, enormous acceleration. But if you were to say, what about the last 50 years of Arab science, or for that matter, Indian science, or Chinese science, let's take a country which is vigorous, you wouldn't be anywhere near as rich in your description about what's happening.
Well, we're at the frontier. But you know, if you look at the history of the Nobel Prize, yes. for example, until World War I, they're French, German, overwhelmingly European, with an occasional American. Since World War II, they're overwhelmingly American.
Right.
And I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that Hitler forced the great scientists out of Europe.
Sure. No, he did American education a great service.
And they trained a huge core of very bright young people, and so Americans moved to the fore. That's a problem I have with China. Suppose China keeps growing at 8 or 9%. Will she be able to change us in scientific leadership? I'm not sure you can. And I base it on the American experience. From about 1870 on, we began sending our best and brightest to Germany and France to train them in, which were in the leadership. And both in the natural sciences and in the social sciences as well. And we benefited from them. But we didn't really seize the leadership for two or three generations. I don't think you can just spend 5 years or 10 years with a master. Because I think a lot of what is at the frontier gets picked up in a conversation between the students and the master, in which the master says, oh no, I didn't mean it quite that way.
Right.
And the subtleties come out through a long period of interaction and argument.
Right.
So you need that, I think you need that proximity.
And the tradition, somehow a tradition that grows and regenerates and creates a standard of excellence.
Right. And I think the tradition comes out of students and teachers interacting closely with each other, not for 4 years, but for a lifetime.
Yeah.
I mean, what are your connections with your students?
Oh, I'm still writing papers.
Sure, you're still writing. My favorite story is about Bob Margo. Bob Margo walked into my office at Harvard one day and said, you know, I was reading a new book on non-parametric methods, and I'm not sure I've got it right. Can I tell you, Professor Fogel, what I've read, and could you tell me if I've got it right? And I said, well, Bob, I don't know all that much about non-parametric methods, but I'll be glad to listen. So he gave me a little 30-minute lecture, and I said, gee, you know, that sounds very good to me. The translation of that conversation was, dear Professor Fogel, there's a very important new book out on non-parametric methods, and you really ought to read it.
Right.
So it's hard to tell. Do we learn more from our students, or do they learn more from us? The interaction is so tight.
No, the interaction. I think here at the University of Chicago, we have an unusual experience with at least the relationship that I had. I've taught at several other universities, and I've had good dealings with faculty. But there's something about this place which seems to bring out that kind of interaction more. Maybe it's the honesty that's insisted on, the kind of openness. But wherever it is, I agree with you, these interactions are the lifeblood of this whole business. And they create the ideas. And traditions are an important part of this. You look at these famous German research universities in the 19th century. I don't really know how they were funded. I don't know how they were financed. I believe many of them were private at that time. Maybe that's not so essential. But there were traditions established, you know, generation after generation of mathematicians, physicists, not so many economists. And that was all destroyed, of course, in the war. I mean, the Nazis. So the question of an economics that could open up really required an open society that just was destroyed, but in an academic environment. So in your question about China, it seems to me the closeness of the Chinese society now doesn't bode so well. Even if their best students come over, once they get back to China, my sense is they don't really interact that much. They don't.
Well, there is something that I've attended three times, I think, in the last 4 or 5 years called something like Society of Chinese Economists. Mm-hmm. And it's a group of Chinese economists trained in the United States, some of whom teach in mainland China. Mm-hmm. Quite a few of them are Taiwanese. Mm-hmm. And maybe a quarter of them are American. Mm-hmm. But as I say, they hold this annual meeting, and they do interact enormously. And they're also very critical of government policy. Mm-hmm. They're not hostile. Their criticism is along the lines, you're not doing it the right way. Right. They're not saying down with the government.
Right.
They're saying, we can get better results if you do A, B, and C. The government is very open-minded to that. They'll come in, they'll call these people up and say, tell us more. What are we doing wrong?
Yet at the same time, I've been to China recently myself. My impression was that, yes, the government's open to criticism at one level, but it's not open to criticism at a more fundamental level, which is collecting information and making it available to analysts. So there's not a tradition of like open debate based on the facts. I mean, there are no data on many important questions in China, as far as I can see.
I think the government is doing its best to improve the economic intelligence system. I really think the Chinese leadership is. Let me tell you a story that who's the president of Harvard now?
Oh, Larry Summers.
Larry Summers.
Sure.
When he was here during the 2000 elections, we have a distinguished speakers series in the Graduate School of Business, and students invited him. Mm-hmm. And a few of us met with him before the talk, and he told me of a meeting that he had with the prime minister, who said Merton Miller was here recently, and he said he thought we should permit derivatives to be sold on the Shanghai Exchange. Mm-hmm. Mr. Summers, what do you think? Should we have derivatives sold? They were picking everybody's mind. Mm-hmm. They were going to make up their own decision, but they wanted to get as wide an input as they could. And I've spoken to some pretty high level people at the level of the high offices of the Central Committee, mm-hmm. or the equivalent of our Congress. One of them is an MBA from UCLA. He was bragging about his having introduced initial public offerings.
I see.
Yeah. Into China. They are really very open-minded about every new idea. They're not going to accept every new idea. They're going to weigh it. And I think they're weighing it not against some Marxist. I think Marxism's
dead.
Yeah, is dead in that country.
I think there are
more Marxists in the United States government than there are there are in the Chinese government.
Well, they've never experienced Marxism, so it's easier to embrace it, I guess.
Right.
It's a general rule.
Right.
No, so, I agree. But still, though, I agree with just saying there's an openness, a curiosity factor that's there, but there's still a closeness in that society. So I can't see it. I think it's going to be quite a while before you get the kind of open debates that you see in American academic life over public policy.
Well, it's certainly, if you compare, yeah, I agree with you on that. You have to be much more careful.
Yeah.
I mean, in the U.S., you can shoot your mouth off anywhere, anytime. And it's part of the tradition.
Right.
And every American politician knows he has to put up with it.
Right.
Even if he doesn't like it. You're right. I mean, I think academics are much more cautious to observe etiquette.
Yes.
But if that etiquette is observed, you can get a lot of substantive points.
You can.
Lay down on the table, and both at intermediate and at top levels, you're going to get a hearing.
But the thing that struck me, and maybe this is just a more general point than China itself, but my impression, I've done a lot of work now in countries around the world. I find it very exciting. I'm now looking at Eastern Europe as well as Latin America, and then now starting China. What strikes me as very distinctive about America and to an extent England, maybe some countries in Western Europe, is an empirical tradition that we have, that we take as for granted. I mean, you know, the Anglo-Saxon political life is an empirical life in some real sense. It's based on facts and it's based on experience in a way that continental Europe isn't, and certainly many countries around the world isn't. So that we
almost have an impatience for pure theory.
Right.
It's empiricists like us who have to convince the policymakers
exactly
that they should invest in pure theory.
And yet it's a very scarce idea still in Latin America and in China and many other countries. I mean, one of the things that I was talking about in Chongqing and in some of the places when I was there in June, was just trying to instill put forward the idea that it would be very helpful to have more information. Economic intelligence is what you called it. And I think, but that's a scarce thing. I mean, we're so used to it. The two of us work with data and we teach it to our students. Our lives are based on it. But many people, many, many people, and many economists, even in the U.S., but especially abroad, issues are settled more by ideology or not even that, some sort of a political correctness within a narrow mode, not even some grand plan, but sort of survival between one administration and the other. So I don't know how to build this tradition. I mean, maybe, do you have some thoughts about this? It's a scarce, rare thing, right, to collect data and use it in public policy.
Yeah, it goes back to counting as sort of central to American political life, and it's in the Constitution.
Right.
You have to have a census every 10 years in order to appropriate the number of members of the House of Representatives.
Right.
And I think the British also, I mean, the the early Petty and the other early classical political arithmeticians were very empirical. So and maybe it goes back to Bacon, a very strong empirical trend in English life, which because we were a part of English society, became a very deep part. And in some ways, we maybe leapfrogged the English on this.
Right, we became super English.
Super English, and exactly. With a little German and French.
A little German and French. But there is this sense, I think it's scarce. I mean, in Germany now, there are schools being set, institutes, right, trying to do empirical work, copying the American model, more like the British model, but really it's an American model, a micro data, empirical work, systematic collection of statistics. But it's a scarce, very rare business still. And the people who do it are at the fringe. You know, the people in the center are still the Herr Doctor professors who are theorists, who are sent, not everyone, but there's a huge bias. But when you leave the continent, you get off to countries like, Latin America, there's almost no tradition of empirical work.
Yeah, well, there sort of the politics dominates.
Exactly.
The economics and the idea. I mean, the basis for politics is ideology.
Right.
So, I suppose.
Do you think that's intrinsic to the culture, or do you think that's intrinsic? Why is it? It's always mystified me why it is. What is it about? I mean, it seems to me that you go back to the intellectual origins of the Spanish Empire, and a lot of it had to do with an extreme form of mercantilism, an extreme form of a deductive logic, which was imposed on the economy. So ideas were taken and imposed. Never, there was no Adam Smith who sort of said, oh, look what's happening. We're gonna induct from this and learn up. But even nobody reads Adam Smith, it seems. Like you take these systems and there's no knowledge that comes out of what actually happens.
I think when you get into the era of the big corporation surfacing, and I guess we're now into Alfred Chandler's world, mm-hmm. Servicing large-scale, far-flung markets, they need an awful lot of information in order to be able to function.
Right.
So those corporations become both the creators and the disseminators of information.
That's true, but usually those are not for public release. They're proprietary data. I'm sure there's a large wealth of data and business transactions that we'll never know and never make its way into the
public. But they influenced what the census was collecting.
Uh-huh, okay.
And from about 1840 on, and especially with 1850, the amount of economic intelligence that's collected by each census gets greater and greater. And the Department of Commerce, through its Bureau of Foreign and Domestic Trade, mm-hmm. starts collecting huge amounts of information for companies that have to trade abroad. And we were, even though it was a relatively small part of our GDP, mm-hmm. we did have a very strong foreign market orientation. So they were generating a lot of information. And I don't think it's an accident that we were the first country to develop the modern GDP accounts. It was Congress, after all, in 1932, that passed the resolution calling on the Department of Commerce to provide an estimate of what last year's gross national last year's national income mm-hmm. had been. And that was the sort of moving from the collection of what you might call regular commercial statistics to a theoretically defined concept of economic intelligence, mm-hmm. where it's what your theory is of how the economy is linked together that tells you what kind of information you ought to be collecting. So I think one of the things that people don't know, by the way, that for people like you and me, there is no Chinese wall between theory and measurement.
No.
That you can't measure without an appropriate theory.
Oh, exactly.
And the results are sensitive to whatever theory you set upon, so you always have to worry about as your theoretical knowledge changes, how do you have to change your measures?
Exactly. I think we've been slow sometimes to adapt the measurements, and we get sort of fixed. And there's always a comparability question, so you want to make it comparable over time, some question. At the same time, you want to adapt to the new technology and new theories. Yeah, no question about it. But we still, warts and all, it's still a much richer institution, this empirical tradition. And I don't think you'd find it in other countries. And you think it's actually linked more or less to the free enterprise system, that that having sort of an open business economy will actually generate a demand for public statistics? That's an interesting theory.
Don't push me too hard. Because it's a feeling I have, not something that I could document.
Well, no, it's interesting, your observation, though, that the census is actually, U.S. Census is really, I can believe it, too, that there was strong pressure from business to actually get information.
Right.
And probably for the same reason, in countries where there was no tradition of a large business, an open enterprise sector, there's no need for facts. So monopolization was the case. Yeah. You didn't need the kind of open society information.
I think also the merchants and the manufacturers were quite intellectual. They were among the leading intellectuals of their day, worrying about the meaning of the rapidity. I mean, things were changing so rapidly in the first half of the 19th century that everybody was struck by it. The commissioner of the 1850 census wrote that the change in mechanical arts were so marvelous during the last decade, we can never be replicated. And then the 1860 census said the same thing.
Right.
And then the commissioner of the 1900 census said, the change in the mechanical arts has been so tremendous in the last half century, it can possibly continue into the future. So that they didn't understand that the point you made earlier, that we were on this accelerating pace of technological change.
But it's interesting, though. See, when you come back to that question, the accelerating pace, see, that's why, you know, if you go back, there was an article in today's New York Times, actually, that triggers this question in part. It was describing the Arab world, which was really a central producer of knowledge 1,000 years ago. And you ask, well, why did the Arab world quit producing ideas? And then why is it that Western society, which is very poor and pretty mediocre by scientific standards in 1600, suddenly starts becoming this cornucopia of ideas, technology, wealth? What is it about it, you think? I mean, I know Hayek had this theory that decentralization, experimentation was the rule in the West, and it wasn't true in the East. But I don't know, as an economic historian, how do you?
Well, you know, David Landis's last book pretty much developed the same idea, that it was the openness, the competitive nature of it, the relatively decentralized role. You didn't have as weaker governments in some way were more conducive to a growth of market promoted institutions. And in some of the countries that did so poorly in the 19th century, it was because you never were able to break the control of the overlords, over the society. So I think there is a lot of loose empirical evidence in favor of the notion that an open society with open markets generates much more creativity than something in which everything is centered around the king or the court or the crown, and in which the crown decides what is permissible and what is not permissible.
So now, would you take that argument to the following extreme? Do you think that government should be in the business of supporting basic research? Because government could be in the role of the king here, it's saying favoring a certain line and suppressing others. I mean, that's a danger with centralized. Or should there be governmental support for basic research and ideas? Or would we run into exactly this danger? People have argued it both ways.
Well, I'm strongly in favor of government patronage of...
Because you're a recipient? Or
Well, I'm sure partly because I'm a recipient and I think my work is good.
Yeah.
I feel the money is being invested properly.
Right.
But partly because it's true of the whole history. I mean, if you, let's say, take great music, it's always been supported by the patronage of great families. Every great composer was under the tutelage of some great house that provided a living to the composer. And I think the same thing was true of basic science. The church, of course, was a very big supporter and a financer of science. And as the church got weakened, the state, to a large extent, took over its role. The problem is not should the state, from my point of view, is not should the state play a role in promoting basic science, but how to do it in such a way that you don't stifle creativity.
Right.
I mean, if you talk about these many dukedoms, each of whom had their house composer and their house scientist, you did have a kind of decentralized science.
Right. Now, there was enough competition.
There's enough competition of ideas.
Yeah.
But I think we have the same problem in a federalized United States, where, and that is, how do you promote really innovative science? The easiest thing to get funded is sort of conventional science.
Right.
It's much harder to get something which is setting off an entirely new direction. And our colleagues here have faced it. Gary Becker was in poor repute. Everybody knows that Bob Lucas's initial breakthrough article was turned down.
Right.
And did you have it so easy from the beginning?
Didn't have it so easy, no. I had a lot of papers rejected, but I wouldn't say they were mistakes to be rejected.
Right.
So I didn't have hostility either. But I mean, I think there was a... I think the society here is open. The academic society is open. But I do think that's changed a bit. I mean, what worries me now is not so much the openness as now maybe, certainly the level of activity in economic research seems to be declining overall. If you look at the number of graduate students going to graduate school, funding for basic research in economics in real terms, if you count all the foundations, I mean, federal government is coming in big with NIH, but the NSF real budget is lower. And foundations are typically not supporting basic research the way they used to. So I wonder if you did an overall accounting, if there isn't a drift away from basic science. And the culture sort of moved away from kind of respecting the fruits of this kind of basic science and basic research. Sort of
on the other hand, Congress has been increasing more and more the budgets for the National Institutes of Health.
Right. Medicine has a huge...
And
support.
A lot of economics is now under the heading.
Oh, it shifted. Exactly.
It shifted. It's being supported to a large extent by the National Institutes of Health.
No, exactly.
So I think maybe the distribution of NSF expenditures is more towards the physical and natural sciences, and the social science component might have gone down in real terms. Mm-hmm. But I think in NIH, it's gone up in real terms, the social sciences.
No, I think the NIH has. It's been
component.
A very, very vigorous push. Sociologists have been very effective and economists too.
Yeah.
So.
And also, if you mean it, Congress will not take up anything with economic policy without hearing what the economists have to say about it.
That's true, though there's an interest. On the other hand, there's now more and more a perception of discord, right, rather than consensus among economists. So. You know, the story of too many voices on the same issue. So yes, they'll listen. So I don't think economists
right. They'll listen and they'll choose between.
Yeah, they'll choose exactly.
But you know, on a whole bunch of things, I think we're maybe 90% in agreement.
Oh, I think so. On basic matters.
On basic matters.
Free trade and sort of open markets.
And how to control the business cycle. I think everybody now agrees that the first line is the Fed.
Right.
That only in a very severe recession is fiscal policy going to be important or play a role.
Right.
Of course, in the kind of short recessions we've had since World War II, we're in the upswing before the result of anything
sure.
the Congress passes.
Yeah, it's way too delayed.
Yeah. So I think on that, maybe the most divisive issues are things that touch on equity.
Yeah.
Where you probably get a pretty big spread of opinion on equity issues. But on what I would call positive issues, how to manage the economy, I think there's a lot of agreement.
There's still some of the same basic questions. I mean, some of the work, for example, arguing that regulation doesn't matter, minimum wages are ineffective, don't cause any harm. That's still getting back to some of the, I think there's still strong strains of the
case. Those are really second order issues now. The big issues are pensions, health care.
Right.
Fiscal stimulus, I think, has been artificially exaggerated since September 11th because of the fear that the reaction to September 11th might push us into a really severe recession.
Right. No,
there's a lot. And so there's been a lot of support for a proactive Congress. But normally we depend on the Fed to do the right thing as far as modulating. I also think that, I mean, my own view, the way I teach it, is that the reason that the business cycle is moderated is because the service sector is not very business cycle prone.
Yeah, no, it's totally, we have a huge service sector now and it's very inelastic really with respect to GDP fluctuations.
And the manufacturing sector, which always was very cyclically sensitive, is still cyclically sensitive. And in what we can't really decide whether we're in a recession or not in a recession, there's no doubt that manufacturing has been in a pretty significant recession.
Oh, for the last 15 months or so,
yeah.
For sure.
But for the economy as a whole, it's not at all clear.
Yeah, that raises a question, though, which is extremely interesting. So much of the research that's been done recently about the so-called new economy is all in manufacturing. But of course, manufacturing, as you just said, is a small and relatively and declining sector. It's still large, but it's declining. And even forgetting the secular, the cyclical factors, the secular factors are sort of moving against manufacturing in the U.S. So it's a strange business that we somehow, our conception of the economy is keyed more and more about a sector that means less and less. And we don't really know productivity measurements.
Right. Well, I think in that sense, the economists have not yet caught up to the economy.
No. There's a danger. We have a certain inbred quality where we don't. I think economists in business schools have an advantage over economists in economics departments in the sense that there's something very tangible. I mean, a business school economist, at the end of the day, is supposed to have a clientele, right? You actually are dealing with a problem. So something as ugly as e-commerce or something that looks very non-classical, very dirty, you know, is a topic where somebody can make a reputation in a business school and create ultimately a huge amount of knowledge because it's a new phenomenon, you know. And I think traditional departments have not been so quick to respond. You know, a few exceptions, of course, individuals, but typically kind of a little stodgier. And I think in that sense,
yeah, business schools, I think you're right. Business schools tend to be more hands on the economy,
exactly,
and less focused on the very pure theory.
Well, let me ask you a question. I mean, I want your reaction to this. I mean, I'm interviewing you now, but I find something interesting. You mentioned Zvi Grelickus a few years ago. I remember talking to Zvi maybe in 97. We were in Paris together. And we were sitting in a cafe. And this was before he was sick. He died, of course, a year or two later. But we were talking about how economics had unfolded in the last 40 years. And he made a very, very interesting remark, which I've actually heard from other people in various forms, but not as strongly as Zvi said. He said when he was young, when the profession was young, as he saw it young, when he was in his 20s, late 20s, early 30s, that there was an enormous respect, maybe too much adulation accorded formal economic theory, that the formalism, the purity of the mathematics, there were economists who devoted their lives to taking standard propositions and making them non-differentiable, but without changing their content. That he said that there was so much respect accorded this, and then throughout his lifetime, this had eroded. And he thought it was a good development. It was a healthy development. Recently, I was also at a Festschrift dinner for Ned Phelps, where somebody stood up and said, well, you know, Phelps was turned down for tenure at Yale. And the argument was, well, at the time, Phelps's kind of economics, you know, this kind of simple models, but rooted to an economic problem. So it had an empirical outlet somewhere. Well, Phelps isn't an empiricist. He's got an empirical problem in mind. Was viewed as very second rate because it wasn't formal, it wasn't theoretically elegant. You have a longer perspective on this than I do. My impression is that, yes, indeed, the profession has moved away from formalism much more towards a kind of active empiricism. But I'd be curious about
that. I'll tell you what my reaction. That formalism, I think, freed us from very strong behavioral assumptions that only generated mathematical characteristics like convexity. And as soon as you knew all you needed was convexity, you could make the behavioral assumptions very, very weak.
Correct.
And yet, so I think if you talk about the model, the mathematical models that were being, the general equilibrium and input-output and linear programming models that were being developed in the 50s and 60s were liberating. In the sense that it got us away from a kind of overbearing set of psychological assumptions about human behavior.
But you don't think it was stifling to the larger enterprise, though? It's kind of created a straitjacket?
Yeah, I think that's sort of, I'm going to be Marxian, that's the dialectics of it.
I see.
That it initially is sort of revolutionary and then it becomes conservative. So that everything has to be some sort of general equilibrium model, and you're changing this little variable or that little variable, and you're seeing how the results change, and you learn nothing about economics. You just learn something about the properties of some set of models.
Right.
So I think we went into that, and that was pretty stifling. It was a waste of time. But we got out of it. You know, there was this commission that Ann Kruger helped establish because of her sense that theory was had overshadowed empirical economics. And, you know, it was probably a good exercise, but had very little influence. But my sense of it is that the field turned itself around. And now when I go around, I see the theorists feel very much on the defensive, that they're not listened to, that they're treated as putterers around. So I think the problem is that, you know, you're not in equilibrium at every point of time. Sometimes you have a little too much of one thing and not enough of the other. And I think it goes back to the point you were making early. What goes along with sort of a new movement is a set of people that become dominant, and maybe their dominance lasts beyond their, if you view it as a piece of intellectual history, beyond their period of maximum usefulness.
Right.
And they go from opening up new ideas to closing down other new possibilities.
Right.
And I think maybe it's a tension that we just have to put up with. There's no way around it. We're never going to, each new intellectual movement is not going to perfectly say, we've had it, we're no longer useful, whatever there was that was opening up new ideas is over. It's always a struggle for new people to come in. And I think maybe it's a necessary struggle because you don't want everybody who says all the old stuff is bad. You don't want to overthrow everything every day with every claim. So you have to have enough of a, there has to be enough steam behind new ideas so that they'll overcome the initial barriers to people being receptive to them.
But let me ask you two questions, actually. And we're over time, so we could stop at any point. But my view is two questions that I'm curious about. You've been in Chicago off and on for close to 40 years, I would guess, 35. I don't know when you came here exactly.
I came here in 63.
63. So overall, with the years at Harvard away, how many years were you at Harvard?
Well, 63, 40 minus 38 minus six, so 32.
32 years, a long time at Chicago. So you've seen the Chicago Department and many versions of the Chicago Department. Now, many people, and you've also been at Harvard, which is the second half of my question here. Many people have argued, recently the argument's been made, is that in some sense, Chicago has become Harvard and Harvard has become Chicago. The roles of the 60s are interchanged in the following sense. Or maybe Chicago has become MIT in the 60s and Harvard and MIT have become Chicago of the 60s. In the sense that in the 1960s, Chicago was not renowned for its kind of formal economic modeling. It had Ozawa, but it was a group of applied economists of the highest stature. Many of them went on to win Nobel Prizes. I mean, that group that you were with, it's a phenomenal group.
Incredible group.
I mean, if Gerlichus had lived a little longer, I'm sure he would have won a Nobel Prize. He should have won
Me too.
So you have an incredible group of people, and Schultz and others, and even those who weren't recognized outside the group were still accorded great respect, like Greg Lewis and people like that. Now my impression is not that Chicago has declined, but it's changed its character a little bit, that the empirical applied economics focus has shifted away from being the core mission of the department, at least the perception of the way department is. And whereas that kind of applied economics has been picked up more enthusiastically at a place like Harvard, for example, where there are probably more empirical economists per capita on the Harvard faculty than there are among, say, the greater percentage. I use the wrong phrase. What do you think about that? I mean, it's frequently stated as
Well, I guess my...
You won't be quoted outside
outside of this video. My reaction to that is we're a relatively small department compared to Harvard or Stanford.
Right.
And if you're down a couple of people in empirical work, it seems like a lot. But you only need to add a couple of people and it'll be restored. And I think the same thing is true. When I left Chicago for Harvard, I was very worried about theory because we were so strong. We just hired you, among other things. We were so strong on the empirical side. When I came back 6 years later, we looked terribly strong on theory, and I thought that the empirical side was being neglected. Mm-hmm. I think we probably have a better balance now.
You think so?
Than we did in 81.
That would include the business school with the department or the department alone?
Well, the business school, I think empiricism is much stronger than in the economics department. But how do you count people like Kevin?
Well, he's both places.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. If you throw in, if you count Kevin, yourself, me, and... Gary has always been someone who pays attention.
Oh, he pays attention to,
the empirical side, and he's always trying to model the evidence. So I think I count him as part of the strength of.
No, he asks. I mean, he may not be an empiricist in a day-to-day sense, but he never lets the economic question get sort of into a formal modeling mode. It's always what. What does this have to say about the larger economic phenomena, the economy that's out there, not some theoretical world out there? No, I agree.
I think we're pretty strong on that.
You think the criticism's not well taken, though? I mean, for example, if you look, for example, at Harvard, you know, very strong groups in empirical work, you know, it's a bigger place.
Their formal functions list has over 100 people.
Right. That's a
lot. It's a lot of people.
Right.
I mean, their tenured faculty is about 50 people.
I think, I agree with you.
So I think you can find a bigger empirical block. I'm not sure on a percentage basis it's stronger. We're just small in everything.
We're small, but somehow having the bureau there, having this sort of flow of data and ideas... There's still a strong legacy, I think, of Gerlichus, you know, sort of looking at data, and there was this eclectic empirical tradition.
Look at the people who won the Nobel Prize here. They all were a strong empiricist.
Yes, I agree. That's a Chicago tradition.
Chicago tradition. And if you compare, let's not say Harvard, but the East Coast tradition.
Right.
Harvard, Yale, MIT is much more theoretical.
Well, I would just conclude, I think there's an enormous political political, we're not going to be able to cover this, but sometimes Chicago is tarred with this political image, or our image that we somehow are driven by some political vision. And I think exactly what you were saying earlier, that's just false. That I think the reason why so many, I mean, Stigler had this remark, right? The reason why so many economists were conservative was because they looked at facts or something to that effect. And I think the fact is that you do look at numbers, you start looking at things, and it does make you, if not conservative, it certainly makes you recognize that things aren't as simple as a simple toy model right. will let you be. So we're not, right. we're much less prone than yeah. the East Coast economists to imagining worlds that don't exist. I mean, this year the Nobel Prize was given to a theory of asymmetric information, which is a very interesting logical theory. The real question is, does it have anything to say about the real world? Is it important? And it's never something that's caught on here, and I think there's a reason for it. And it's not something that would ever catch on here, in the sense of, because it's theoretically a nice idea, people read it, but do they want
to put it?
It's hard to put it in practice. Yeah. Do we really think people are going to college just to prove how smart they are, and so forth and so on? So there's an empiricism here. So in some sense, we're the inheritors of this English empirical tradition here at Chicago. But I've always envied you. You were there in the economics department in the 60s, and if there's any vintage, there should be written a book someday about Chicago, 1960 to 1970. That, you know, maybe at the time when Grylicus left, but seemed like an incredibly exciting group of people, all of whom went on to great success, not tiny success.
Our generation owes itself to them because they hired us. we're their chosen successors.
Bob, this is fantastic talking with you. You're always a stimulating source of ideas. I read your work. I consider you one of the great influences in how I've become an economist. Being at Chicago, you learn by doing, and you also learn by observing. And observing you and trying to follow along some part of your way has been very, very inspiring.
Let me finish the other side of this mutual admiration society. I knew very early on, and I think I told you on several occasions, that I expected you to win a Nobel Prize pretty soon. And you came in at well below the median age for winning the prize.
Well, it's going to come down. There was a backlog, don't forget. But I appreciate that. You have been very kind, and it's been stimulating. I think we always think we're both empirically oriented, as I think the place is fundamentally. The place is fundamentally, and that's what keeps it moving. You can get, if you get hung up on models about, I like this model or I like that model, and people can disagree ferociously, but the facts end these disagreements.
That's right.
And that's, I believe.
That's the way I've always actually approached it that way.
Yeah.
There are a lot of good theories. How do I know which one to believe?
Right.
Look, you've got to have the numbers.
Got to have the numbers, and if maybe the numbers won't tell you, but at least it gets rid of some of the bad theories.
Right.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media Podcast.